Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jeff Humfeld. Today, host Keith Brown L. talks with Latara Smith of the KC Freedom Project about the draft report of the Missouri State Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights and their investigation into how the KC Police Department and the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office handles citizens' complaints. In the second half, host Margot Patterson talks with Alex Holsinger, professor of criminology at UMKC, about his research on the risks of recidivism and what those leaving prison need to successfully re-enter society. Stay tuned for the calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast, and then we wind up the show with the 420 drug war news. Now, coming up is Keith and his guest.
My name is Keith Brown Eel. Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio.
Last year in 2015, the Missouri Advisory Committee to the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights held hearings in St. Louis and Kansas City to examine the disparities which often exist in law enforcement to undermine equal protection under the law and on the basis of color. Latara Smith has been one of KC's most persistent activists in trying to call attention to this problem. She is here today along with Mr. Anthony Williams to talk about their experiences and their efforts in these matters.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Would you please introduce yourself?
Hi, my name is Latara Smith. I'm the director of the KC Freedom Project here in Kansas City, Missouri.
And you, sir?
And I'm Anthony Williams, director of the Missouri Prisoner Advocacy Consulting, LLC, currently based in Columbia, Missouri.
Briefly, can you give us a little bit of background about your organization and your work?
Well, the KC Freedom Project, we are an advocacy group, and we advocate for those who are wrongly convicted. We assist them with their cases and, help to get their injustice brought to the light and, which blissfully will lead to their vindication and or exoneration.
We at the Missouri Prisoner Advocacy Consulting, we do some of the same similar work. I was wrongly convicted myself, and so I'm trying to bring some of the knowledge and experience that I gained from fighting my wrongful conviction to assist others and give others insight and guidance and to get people to the help they need.
All right, Mr. Williams, how long have you been out of incarceration?
Coming up on 2 years, July 3rd would be two years exact.
Okay, now were you able to attend this hearing that was held by the Commission on Human Rights of the Missouri Advisory Committee?
No, sir, I was not able to attend that meeting, sir.
Okay, now, Latara, I know you were able to attend, so could you tell us a little bit about what took place while you were at that meeting?
Yes. At the meeting, there was a panel, and there was, several high-ranking officials from Jackson County that was actually there. Mrs. Baker was there to represent the prosecutor's office. Alvin Brooks was there to represent the police department. I believe there was a Mike Sharp that was there to represent the sheriff's office. There were some other organization, some agency leaders that were there. I just can't simply recall them right now, but they were all on the panel. And the purpose of this meeting to hearing, to my understanding, was to go over issues pertaining to, police misconduct and such, or the relations between the police department and the people here within our community.
Okay, now, what kind of impression did you come away with after you had attended this meeting?
Well, to be honest with you, I felt that the commission people that were there were kind of misled by some of our agency leaders, specifically when it came to the complaint process here at the Kansas City Police Department. They were somewhat misleading to me.
Okay, first of all, I want you to tell us what do you mean by being misleading, and then I want you to talk about the complaint process and how it's operated or alleged to have operated.
Okay. Well, to be specific, what I mean by misleading is, as I stated, Mr. Brooks was there to represent the KCPD Board of Commissioners as being the president. And when he spoke of our crime rate here in Kansas City and referred to Ad Hoc as being an agency that is causing the crime rate to go down, which, I don't know if that's true or not, but when he made them aware of this, he mentioned Ad Hoc, but what he didn't mention to the organization or to those people that were there from the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights is the fact that he was the director of Ad Hoc for many years. I think he had just stepped down a couple of months before. And that's what I mean by misleading, because I feel that he should have, you know, made them aware that he also held that position.
Okay, what kind of organization is Ad Hoc?
Ad Hoc, to my understanding, is it's an organization, you know, you can go to, from what I know of it, as per the website for the police department, it is an agency, an organization that you can go to report issues of police misconduct. Now, I do believe they handle a lot of various other issues as well, but that one specifically is what I'm talking about and referring to today.
Okay. Now, what about, don't they have another body here in Kansas City that you refer complaints to specifically about police misconduct?
Well, there's some other agencies. I can't recall their name right now, but I do know that Ad Hoc is most definitely one of the agencies.
What about the Citizens Complaint Review Board or something like that? What do they call it?
Well, the Office of Community Complaints, I believe the director of that office is Mrs. Pearl Fain. That office is actually part of the Kansas City Police Department, if I'm not mistaken. I know that they are governed by the KCPD Board of Commissioners according to their website. But Ad Hoc is an agency that you can go in, it's listed as an agency that you can go and make complaints about police misconduct. And then from there, I guess they go over it with the Office of OCC over there with Pearl Fain. And, you know, then they take it from there is what I understand.
Okay, now hold that thought. Mr. Williams, could you tell us a little bit about your experiences in the criminal justice system, how you became involved in the work that you do right now, and what led to you being in a situation where you got tangled up in the system, if that's not too personal?
No, that's not too personal. I'm out of the city of St. Louis, a community much like the communities that you guys are fighting for here in Kansas City. I was wrongly convicted of first-degree murder as a 14-year-old kid. Primarily, the reason why I was wrongly convicted was due to a haphazard police investigation that started from the beginning, where they
went into a situation with their minds made up that you were automatically guilty.
Yes, sir. They did not take the care and concern that you would think police officers would take when trying to solve a crime as serious as murder, and especially dealing with a bunch of kids. Basically, they were going up and snatching up kids and accusing them of this crime. And none of this information had been disclosed to my defense attorney, et cetera. So we went into trial thinking that the witnesses that had misidentified me, they were leading on like they were positive in their identifications. And actually, they had basically pointed out two other kids prior to pointing me out, saying that it was me. And the police never revealed that to no one, so we had no knowledge of knowing that eyewitness testimony was as bad and tainted as we found out that it was.
Latara, I have a question I want to ask you. Now, we've been hearing rumors now, and we don't know if they're true, that the Kansas City Police Department is no longer using what do they call it, lying about eyewitness identification and things of this nature here in their investigations. Have you been able to confirm that?
You know, I'm not for sure. Actually, I haven't heard that. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard that at all, so mm-hmm. I can't say yay or nay on that one.
Okay, well, did you have something else that you wanted to add?
Well, you know, he talked about a tainted, a botched investigation, basically. And that's actually what led me to that meeting that day on the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, because I had several complaints pertaining to the conduct of the Kansas City police detectives who investigated the homicide that Keith Carnes was wrongly convicted in. That's what led me there to speak to them about this complaint process, because of the fact that there were some issues with the time span that you have to turn in your complaints, okay? So if there's a time span, and I believe that time span is 90 days, and if you don't submit your complaint before that 90 days, then it's just null and void. Well, sometimes, you know, people are incarcerated and they don't have access to their records. Or, you know, in Keith Carnes' case, or even, say, Jerome Clark's case, it was years later when that was discovered, when the police misconduct that took place, which was, you know, tainted probable cause statements, police officers giving purge testimony, that did not come out until years later. So, you know, most people, when they think about police misconduct, they think about, you know, brutality, excessive force. But actually, police misconduct takes place a lot when you look at wrongful convictions in the reports, falsifying reports, botched investigations. And in Keith Carnes' case, these officers committed state criminal charges, and they have yet to be held accountable.
You're listening to 90.1 FM. KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Keith Brown Ill. This is Jaws of Justice, and I am talking with Ms. Latara Smith and Anthony Williams about police misconduct and the U.S. Committee on Civil Rights investigation into those matters. Mr. Williams, have you encountered other situations in St. Louis or elsewhere in the state of Missouri that came close in similarity to what you experienced when you became involved with your legal situation?
Sure. I'm glad we're here today talking about police accountability. I think that is something that really needs to be addressed when we talk about crime in general. I believe that a lot of advocacy groups like mine and Latara's and other advocacy groups here in Missouri that advocate on behalf of people who are confronted with the justice system believe that, like, we don't believe in criminal justice, and we do. But we believe that also that it has to be accountability around the board.
Right, right.
You know, we have all these draconian laws in our state. We have 2.3 million people incarcerated in the United States. And like, but where's the, we're holding our citizens accountable, but when are we going to start holding these state officials and the police officers accountable? Like, that's what groups like the Missouri Prisoner Advocacy Consulting and Kansas City Freedom Project, that's what we do, and that's what we need to be doing, is holding the police accountable as well. If we think that if we want to ever curb crime and try to reduce our prison population.
Okay, Latara, can you tell me a little bit about this Citizens Complaint Review Board? If you only have 90 days to report an incident of police misconduct, and say, for instance, you're already incarcerated, you're not able to get out on bond or whatever, for whatever reason, and how would you go about trying to get your complaint to this board, because information I got is that you have to make these complaints in person.
Right. Well, that was the other part that I mentioned, that I felt the complaint process was not fair, because if you're locked up and you can't make this complaint within 90 days, some people can't get out. You know, maybe they have to have multiple bond hearings before their bond is going to be reduced to where they can, you know, pay to get out. So
if they can pay to get out.
If they can pay to get out. Amen. But that was my question to them. Because unless a person knows that, a significant other, you know, a mother, wife, husband, brother, girlfriend, or whomever could not go and make that complaint for that individual. So according to the way that it is in their policy, it specifically states that, you know, if it's past 90 days, I know in Mr. Carnes' case, I submitted 15 complaints. Ms. Jerome Clark submitted complaints. And because they were submitted after 90 days, they were null and void. Now, they gave testimony. Assistant, Pearl Fain's assistant there over the Office of Community Complaints, gave testimony that day that it is at the discretion of the director whether or not they should accept these, if they will accept the complaints after 90 days. Now, I have yet to see that happen, because I actually submitted 15 complaints in Keith Carnes' case after the hearing, and we were denied. And I don't think that's cool, because they should act accordingly. You know, the police department should be held accountable. I mean, come on. You have police officers in this case that committed state criminal, you know, they broke the law. So just because Mr. Carnes didn't notice this within 90 days, the police get a go on it? They get a pass on it? No, it shouldn't be that way. It should be confronted.
Now, were you told that they actually go to the jails and to try to gather complaints of people who have been arrested and make their rounds periodically to make sure that everybody's complaints get heard?
Yes. And actually, anyone that gets a hold to the report of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, it is there in the testimony, the transcripts by the assistant, I think the director, I can't recall his name right now. But yes, he did say that they are often, he himself is often there in the jail, and they make themselves easily accessible for the inmates to you know, make those complaints. But I've from people I speak with, they never had that option. So,
well, I'd like to point out that last year I had the misfortune of spending several months in the county jail myself, and I never saw any of those people making any rounds. And matter of fact, I had spoke with some of the staff members there and said that I had some complaints that I wanted to file against the Kansas City Police Department for misconduct. And they told me that, well, you're just going to have to wait till you get out. I said, well, what if I don't get out? So what? You know, it's pretty much is what they told me. Mr. Williams, did you have something that you wanted to add?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to add something pertaining to these deadlines in our system. One of the things that I like to say is that you are the master of your defense. And ignorance of the law is no excuse. Oftentimes, people get trapped in the system and don't understand these deadlines. Deadlines to file a complaint, deadlines to file a motion to argue that your lawyer was ineffective. Various deadlines in the system that if a person does not have working knowledge of the law, they basically lose their rights. So that's why we hope that people listen to these radio shows and become more informed of their rights. And because if you don't know your rights, then you lose them.
Latari, did you have something you wanted to add to
that? Yeah, actually, I just looked down at the report, and the gentleman's name is Merrill Benikin. Is the one who was the representative from the Office of Community Complaints that gave that testimony about is at the discretion of the director to, you know, take the complaints after 90 days. So that's where my question is, what is the discretion of the director? That's kind of an open, broad, you know, thing. But you would think, being a representative of the police department, that you would want to make sure and address any police misconduct, no matter how long it took place. If those officers are still there and these detectives are there, they've moved up in rank. So they got a pass. They got a pass on not acknowledging, you know, not being held accountable. And as a result of that, we have an innocent man sitting in prison to this day.
Well, I talked about my experiences a while ago, and in all fairness, I had to say that the situation is not limited to just the experiences that I had. Have you encountered anybody else that said they were able to get their complaints to this board in a timely fashion after being incarcerated or otherwise?
No. Everyone that I've, the cases that I have, everyone's complaint was turned away because it was made past the 90 days. Was that your question?
Yes,
it was. They were turned away. Jerome Clark situation, where, you know, police officer lied, resulted in his wrongful conviction, life with no parole. He was turned away, and he sent his in a few years ago, and was, you know, he was turned away.
Okay, now when they had the hearing here in Kansas City, who were the people that were on that board again?
There was Alvin Brooks, who was there to represent the police department, Gene Peters Baker for the prosecutor's office. Mike Sharp was there for the county sheriff. I know that the new director of ad hoc, Damon, I believe is his name, he was there. There was a couple of other. Mr. Benikin was there to represent the Office of Community Complaints. That's all that I can really recall right off the top.
And did they take any questions from the audience?
They did after their panelists spoke, and then they were allowed to leave, and then we, the public, was allowed to step to the podium and voice our opinions.
But the people who were actually there to officiate, they got up and left after they said their piece.
Right, and I questioned the board, you know, why they did that, and they said they didn't want it to be a confrontational situation or make them feel as though, you know, they were being attacked. So they were allowed to speak about their agencies, then immediately leave. Now, of course, I would have wanted it to be different, but oh well.
Okay, now, could you give us some contact information and some recommendations about what else can be done to try to bring more light into this situation that's under a considerable amount of darkness?
Well, you know, what I always say is people in the community, they need to get involved. You know, we have a lot of activists here in Kansas City, and this is not to discredit any other activists, but the activists need to be more persistent, and we also need to come together. I think we can get a lot more done coming together instead of being a bunch of small groups and entities, but to come together, because at the end of the day, we're all fighting for the same thing, okay? And so that's very important. That's most definitely something I want to get out there.
And we also have to understand that, you know, we can't limit these type of actions to one day events. You know, a lot of people think that they come out, you know, they make a lot of noise on one day, then they go home and they, you know, go back to doing whatever they was doing before these incidents. And then we look up, we're in the same situation again. This is not a one day event. It's not a 2 day event. It's not a week event. It's not a month. It's at the rate that things are occurring here in Kansas City and elsewhere all over the country, this is a year long struggle. You have to give whatever time you can afford to sacrifice, and you have to be persistent, just like you said. Mr. Williams, could you give us your contact information?
You can find me on Facebook, Missouri Prison Advocacy Consulting. Also, I have a website I'm about to launch soon, MissouriPAC.org. And I agree with Latar that we do need to come together, and that's why I'm here in Kansas City, and that's why I've been working with Latar. And we're trying to bridge the gap between the cities and everything, and trying to really do something about reforming our criminal justice system.
Now, are you just living here in Kansas City, or are you going back from Kansas City to St. Louis, working in both areas?
Well, I'm currently living in Columbia, Missouri, but yeah, I pretty much work in Kansas City as well as St. Louis and some other parts of the state as well.
Now, we spoke about these deadlines that are set up by the Board of Complaints. In your opinion, are these deadlines, Latara, and the rules made to keep people from registering their complaints?
I believe so, and that's actually what the opinion that I voiced that day, that it is biased to individuals being able, I mean, you know, it's not cool. It's blocking them from getting their reports made.
Okay, now we only have a few minutes left. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that you may want to add before we leave there?
You know, I just want everyone to know that we most definitely need to be persistent in this. And the KCPD needs to change that. They need to change that 90-day limit. They most definitely need to change it.
I think the KCPD, like most other police departments here in the country, they need to change a lot of things.
Well, the Office of Community Complaints, who is governed by the KCPD Board of Commissioners, let me correct that, okay, because I'll get a call about that tomorrow if I don't.
Mr. Williams, you have anything you want to add before we leave there?
Yeah, I just want to add that for all you people out there who have loved ones incarcerated, this is the time now that we can change the tide. We're building public opinion, and we're raising awareness of these wrongful convictions and excessive sentencing. Please, you all, come out and support us in our efforts to reform this criminal justice system.
Thank you for being on the show, both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Calendar for April 25th, 2016. The Human Dignity and Economic Justice Coalition will meet with Mayor Sly James Monday, April 25th, commencing at 12 noon and concluding at 1:30 p.m. at the Metropolitan Missionary Baptist Church, 2310 East Limwood Boulevard, KCMO. Everyone is invited to attend this meeting and invite others to come as well. They will be discussing the KCMO budget priorities and more. The Reverend Dr. Wallace S. Hartsfeld, Sr. is the convener. The KCMO branch of the NAACP with the Sierra Club and Sustainable Sanctuaries are hosting an environmental justice forum Tuesday, April 26th, 6:30 p.m. at the Brush Creek Community Center, 3801 Cleaver 2 Boulevard, KCMO. Kendra Glover, National NAACP Program Manager of the Environmental and Climate Justice Program, will present the NAACP's Cold-Blooded Report, followed by a panel discussion dealing with coal plants in urban communities. The 12th Annual Truce Fest will be held from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Saturday, May 21st on Troost Avenue between Linwood and 31st Street. If you would like to help plan and present this year's festival, the committee meets daytimes on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. and in the evenings at 7:30 p.m. at 3101 Troost Avenue, KCMO. There is still plenty of room for vendors and exhibitors. This year's theme, Everyday People Living Together. My name is Jeff Humfeld, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. Coming up next is Margo and her guest, Professor Alex Holsinger.
This is Margo Patterson with Jaws of Justice. My guest today is Alex Holsinger, a professor of criminology at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, who has helped corrections departments on both sides of the state line come up with better treatment plans for individuals in prison. Professor Holsinger is an expert in the field of risk and needs assessment as regards probation and parole. There's a growing body of research that indicates that building a successful life outside prison is more complicated than just getting a job and staying away from other ex-cons. Professor Holsinger has done some of that research, and he's here to talk to us about it. Professor Holsinger, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
What do we now know that we might not have known 25 years ago about who is going to find it easier to make the transition to life outside prison and who's going to be at a higher risk of recidivism?
Well, that's a very complicated question, but I think what we know now versus a couple decades ago is just the extent to which behavioral change takes a long time and is a very difficult thing to help somebody do. Criminal behavior is just like any other type of behavior, and we are all products of reinforcement. We're all products of the things that we've been rewarded for, the things that we've experienced consequences or punishments for. And criminal behavior is just another one of those types of behaviors. And now I would say a couple decades later now, since the 80s and even early 90s, we understand, how difficult behavioral change, long-term behavioral changes, and B, we have a better understanding of how to help people change their behaviors, in this case, criminal behavior.
When you say we have a better understanding of how to help people change their behavior, do you think then case management is better today than it used to be? Are people who are coming out of prison now more likely to receive treatment more appropriate mm-hmm. to their individual needs?
I do think that that case management is absolutely key. And just to be clear for the audience, when we're talking about case management, we're talking about specifically how a probation officer, for example, or a parole officer interacts with and manages the case of somebody that they are supervising. And so now, in today's correctional world, we understand more of what the ex-offender needs in order to live a fully functional life. And so we understand better the importance of pretty basic but very important things like employment and the need for further education if that's a deficit. But we also have a better understanding of the role that substance use and abuse plays and how to help somebody manage their substance using behavior. In most cases that would be eliminate substance using behavior or largely eliminate. But the biggest, I would say the biggest advance in the last couple decades is our understanding of the role of what are referred to as cognitions, essentially thoughts, feelings, attitudes, and belief patterns that contribute to our behavior. And in the case of somebody that's involved in the criminal justice system or the correctional system, the cognitions that are related to keeping them mired in a criminal lifestyle. So cognitions or thought patterns are probably one of the most important advances, or our understanding of cognitions and thought patterns as it relates to criminal behavior is probably the biggest and most important advancement in the last 20 years.
So are parole and probation officers basically kind of giving cognition therapy or cognitive therapy to the people they're supervising?
Yes and no. I would say that one of the related to what I just mentioned is one of the biggest shifts in terms of the focus on cognitions. One of the biggest shifts in correctional supervision, so probation and parole officers, is a shift away from what we refer to as the standard conditions of probation. So, or the standard conditions of supervision. So, when somebody is placed on supervision in the community, so they have a supervision officer, like a probation or parole officer that they have to report to. In the past, probation and parole officers have focused mainly on what are referred to as the standard conditions of supervision. And those are the things that the court says that the offender must or must not do. Like, for example, you must maintain employment, or if you don't have employment, you must get employment within 30 days. You may not live within 1,000 feet of X, Y, and Z. You may not enter into a place that serves alcohol. You may not work at places that do X, Y, and Z. So we have what are referred to as the standard conditions of supervision. And that for a long time was largely what supervising a case was all about. So if I was a probation officer and you were my offender, when we would meet once a week or maybe a couple times a month, you would have a seat and we would talk, and I would say, have you had an address change that you didn't let anybody out? Have you had any contact with the police department? Have you used any drugs or alcohol? Have you socialized with any ex-felons? No. Okay, great. I'll see you in a couple weeks. And I don't want to belittle that function because it's important. It's important for the person who's on supervision to be accountable for the things that they have to do. But focusing just on those things doesn't do a whole lot to help somebody change their behavior. Now, we are at the beginning. I would say in the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen a major sea change in the area of the profession of correctional supervision. And more officers are now being trained in the principles. You mentioned cognitive therapy. They're being trained in the principles of cognitive behavioral interventions. And what that means is that we've found now, and there's a growing body of research to support this, we found that when officers incorporate these core principles of behavioral change, when they incorporate discussion of cognitions and crime-producing needs and risk factors, rather than just focusing on where have you been, what have you done, is there anything I need to know, you know, those are real basic things. When officers focus on the things that matter, we see a real impact in helping people reduce recidivism, reduce their return into the correctional system.
What's the difference between probation and parole?
Probation supervision is when somebody has been, for example, the most typical example would be somebody commits a crime, they're arrested, they're processed, they plead guilty or are found guilty, and the judge decides to assign them to probationary supervision. So they go straight from committing the crime or being convicted of the crime to being on supervision in the community. Parole supervision means somebody committed a crime, they were found guilty, they were sent to prison, and so they serve some time in prison, and then they are let out of prison and placed on supervision with a parole officer. Now, those two things, parole supervision and probation supervision, they look very similar on paper, but the main distinction, and I think it's an important distinction, and I appreciate you asking the question, because a lot of people get it mixed up, just like people often don't understand the difference between jail and prison. But the difference between probation and parole is that somebody who's on parole served time in prison first, and then is placed on supervision after they're released.
In a conversation we had a few days ago, you mentioned that rehabilitative programs have gotten a bad rap, mainly because of bad programming. You use the word quack programming. What is good programming look like versus bad programming in prisons?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I would say is that we the field of corrections needs the field of corrections needs a lot more effective programming, and that's really a lot of what I've spent much of my career doing is working with treatment programs, rehabilitation programs that serve and work with offenders become more effective. Now, that said, there is a lot of, and the term I used when we spoke a few days ago was there's a lot of correctional quackery going on out there, and it's kind of a funny term, but the implications are not at all funny, because essentially we have a lot of programs that are not doing any of the things that we know are effective in helping people change their behavior. Now, the major downside of that is that what happens is that we have offenders go through these programs, and then, you know, since we love to hang labels on people, we say to them, oh, you've finished, here's your certificate of completion, you've finished Pathways to Change, or you've finished, you know, Moving On, or you've finished all these other programs, and so you should be fixed now. Well, when in reality, if that program wasn't doing doing anything that's effective in helping change people's behavior, they haven't experienced effective treatment. And so that gives treatment a bad name, you know, because then you have a situation where someone says, well, you know, you've been through these programs, but you haven't changed your behavior. Oftentimes we blame the offender and say, well, you must be incorrigible. What's wrong with you? You've had all these programs, but you haven't successfully changed your behavior. When in reality, it's the programs that have been failing and that haven't been doing what we know are effective. Now, some of the more effective programs, getting back to the area of what I mentioned before, cognitions, the most effective programs are those that focus on in an active as opposed to passive way, focus on the cognitions that essentially help people maintain their criminal behavior. Now, when I talk about cognitions, I'm talking about things like rationalizations, justifications, neutralization. So, for example, a couple typical examples that I'll give when explaining what I mean by crime-producing cognitions. You know, when someone says, for example, well, I know I shouldn't have beaten my spouse, but they shouldn't have disrespected me in front of my friends. Okay, anytime there's a but, you know, there's a good chance that's a criminogenic thought pattern that's going to come, because the statement should be, I know I shouldn't have beaten my spouse. Right, that's where it should end, because you need to recognize that that's inappropriate behavior, pretty much regardless of the circumstances that preceded that behavior. Or another more common example is someone who says, well, marijuana is legal in all these other states. It just happens to not be legal here, so it's no big deal. Now, I'm not here to debate, you know, the merits of marijuana legalization or not, but the bottom line is that if you live in a jurisdiction where it's illegal, you're exposing yourself to potential trouble by engaging in it. So that's an example of a neutralization or a justification or a rationalization when it comes to, in this case, you know, drug using behavior. It's like, well, it's legal everywhere and it should be legal here, so it's really not a big deal. Now, it may not be a big deal necessarily, but the bottom line is if it's against the law, you're running the risk of getting in trouble. And so that's another example. So the programs that are most effective are the programs that help people identify their antisocial, meaning against the norm, you know, help people recognize their faulty thought patterns that are compelling them to remain in trouble.
Well, a lot of these sound like very natural thought patterns that people have every day about any number of activities. I would think it might be very difficult to convince people that there is really something faulty in their mm-hmm. thinking, as opposed to you're being very unrealistic in assessing the situation and mm-hmm. not considering all these other factors.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd like to add to this discussion that we all have the ability and the wherewithal to rationalize our own negative behaviors. You know, nobody wants to think of themselves poorly, or very few people want to think of themselves as poorly or as a bad person. But we do. Many of us do bad things, and we need to explain those away so we can live with ourselves, so to speak. But really, another characteristic of an effective program are programs that help offenders do sort of a cost-benefit analysis of every behavior. And I personally have found this to be really, you know, really useful in illustrating examples for officers who are working with offenders. So, you know, take the example of using drugs, okay? Using drugs in an abusive manner, in a chronic, you know, addictive manner. Using drugs has some benefits, right? It's fun, it's exciting, it's social. Right, I'm just speaking very generally here. Those would be sort of immediate benefits. Some of the immediate costs could be getting caught, getting in trouble. Right, the long-term benefits of chronic drug use, that's typically a much shorter list. So you ask somebody, well, what are the long-term benefits of using heroin daily for 30 years? What do you think the end of those 30 years are going to look like? And even the most, you know, you'd have a hard time with anybody coming up with long-term benefits of that sort of thing. What are the long-term consequences then? What are the long-term negatives of 30 years of heroin use? Well, death, right? Premature death, compromised health, continual involvement in the correctional system if you're getting caught, and things of that nature. And so again, I'm oversimplifying, of course, but good treatment programs are the ones that do these sorts of exercises. There's other exercises called thinking reports that again help ask the offender to present a recent scenario and how they respond to it, and having the offender write that out, assuming they're able to do that, and identify where their thinking went wrong, for example. And then not just where their thinking went wrong, but then helping the offender identify what different choices they could have made. All right. And really, really breaking things. And most of us don't have to think about our thinking because we are, to varying degrees, fully functional adults that don't get in a lot of trouble. We don't abuse substances to any substantial degree. So we don't have to think about the thought processes that drive our behavior. That's not the case with somebody who's been involved in a criminal lifestyle for a long time. Their thinking is just as automatic as ours is, but the difference is that their thinking leads them to getting into a lot more trouble than you or I perhaps ever could. And so it's necessary to really, really break thinking down, break these cognitions down and into pieces and help identify at each piece where there's a fork in the road, and helping folks understand why choosing the right path, the path that's going to keep them in trouble, is going to lead to a better life down the road.
This is Margot Patterson with Jaws of Justice, and if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Alex Holsinger, a professor of criminology at UMKC. You said that there's good data out there to create more effective treatment programs, but there's often resistance to change within the corrections field. How do you go about incentivizing and encouraging probation and parole officers to change, or other correction officers too?
Oh, that's a big and a very good question. I'm going to answer this from my perspective and the work that I've done with a lot of the correctional professionals in our community, and that is to simply present people, in some cases repeatedly, present people with the evidence. I'm a researcher by trade, and so I and many of the people that I work with and collaborate with are in the business of producing using the scientific method in producing evidence that demonstrates the effectiveness of much of what we've been talking about. And so when you're able to demonstrate using objective studies that show, okay, when we do option A, we have a recidivism rate of 70%. When we do option B, we have a recidivism rate of 50%. Let's go with option B. Let's talk about what option B is. And just making sure that people aren't just presented with the evidence, but understand the evidence and understand what goes into option B, what goes into the options that give us lower recidivism rates. That's to me, I've had the good fortune of working with a lot of mentors who are still very active in the field. I trained under Ed Latessa, who is a national figure in this whole area, and he and I have both continued to give presentations all over the country to audiences of probation officers and as importantly, administrators within corrections, and also as importantly, policymakers like politicians and judges who need to hear this information so they understand what role they play in making our correctional system more rehabilitative, and that's really where my core professional mission lies, is in spreading this information, making it accessible, making it so people can look at it and understand it in a relatively easy, quick fashion, but more importantly, understanding how they can incorporate what we know is effective into their everyday lives. Just like we were talking about earlier, in terms of the biggest sea change when it comes to probationary supervision, we're starting to move away from focusing on those standard conditions of supervision and moving toward probation and parole officers actually doing things that are helping people change their behavior, doing those thinking reports that I mentioned, doing those cost-benefit analyses and things of that nature.
What do you think makes for a good parole or probation officer?
What makes for a good parole or probation officer? Well, first of all, I'd say they'd be a graduate of UMKC, of my department. They would, but speaking a little bit more broadly, I would say that somebody who has the ability to empathize. I think empathy is a very important characteristic, meaning being able to empathize with somebody who's involved in the system and who isn't going to allow being a felon or being on supervision or being an ex-prison inmate is going to allow that not to be somebody's master status. I think there's real danger in looking at somebody or putting a label on somebody and acting as though that label explains everything there is about them. So when we have terms like ex-felon, or when we use terms like sex offender, or when we use terms like ex-inmate, you know, and I should add also, I've been guilty of using these labels in the context of this interview. But when we allow those labels to explain everything that we need to know about that person, there's real danger. So I would say that a good probation parole officer has the ability to empathize and has the ability to not allow those labels to serve as the person's master status. Coupled with that is a probation or parole officer who embraces their role as a we call the term in the field is an agent of change, who embraces their role as being an agent of change in terms of helping this person change their behavior in the long term. There's a big difference between being an officer that says, okay, my job is to make sure that all these boxes are checked, to make sure that you submit to your analysis on time, and to make sure that you don't have any contact with the police, or if you do, to report it. That's an important part of the job, and I don't want to belittle that. But I would much rather that be combined with some of these behavioral change strategies that we've been alluding to.
You mentioned that we have a justice system that inadvertently encourages people staying in the prison system rather than leaving it. Could you say more about that?
Well, I think, yeah, I was just simply referring mainly to the things that we do, the things that the system does that don't help people leave. Like, for example, mandating that people who have been convicted of a felony report that on a job application. I understand why people want to know that information, but I think it would be better if people didn't have to report that sort of thing, and were more apt to get an interview, especially if it's a job where somebody's going to have a background check done anyway, because you're going to find out if someone has a felony conviction in their past, regardless. But I think, and again, you know, getting back to sort of master status, I think that we tend to use those labels, those negative labels, and those labels are what keep people mired in the system.
Last question for you, Professor Holksinger. Any key misconceptions that you think people have about the prison system, the criminal justice system in this country?
Misconceptions? Well, I think, I don't know if this is a misconception or if it's an area that I think there just needs to be more awareness of. Oftentimes, when I speak with neighbors and friends who aren't, you know, who don't work in criminal justice or who aren't as familiar with the correctional system as myself and my colleagues are, there's a failure to understand that the vast majority of people who are in prison are going to come back to our community. The vast majority, 95%, maybe as high as 97%. Very few people spend their entire lives in prison. Most everybody comes back, and so I think. We all need to ask ourselves and continually ask ourselves, who do we want coming back to our communities? Because they're coming back whether we want them to or not. And I think we owe it to ourselves and we owe it to them to do everything we can to help them lead functional lives.
Professor Holksinger, thank you so much.
You are very welcome. I'm happy to be here.
And now stay tuned for the 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News.
It seems every day the truth about this drug war just gets a little larger, gets a little more recognized. And there's a situation up in Canada that's just baffling to me. They're fixing to legalize marijuana at some point, hopefully within the next year, and yet there's a gentleman up there who's giving away marijuana seeds with the intent to, in essence, overgrow the government. As far as I know, cannabis seeds are legal in Canada, and yet this gentleman, Mr. Dana Larson, has run into a bit of trouble on his travels and his distribution efforts. Dana, what in the heck's going on in Canada?
Well, you know, the laws in Canada are very confusing right now, and they've been this way for a long time because we've been engaging in a very massive and successful campaign of civil disobedience against Canada's cannabis laws. And so in Canada, we have very strict laws against bongs and pipes being sold. We have laws against books about marijuana. We have laws against dispensaries and seed banks. And you're wrong, actually, marijuana seeds are illegal in Canada. But these laws are not enforced anymore, and so it creates this bizarre dichotomy. There's bong shops all across Canada. There's hundreds of dispensaries openly selling medical marijuana. There's seed banks. There's books and information. All these things that are banned are available pretty much everywhere. And so the laws aren't really enforced, and it's because we've resisted these laws. People used to get busted for selling bongs. You know, people like Mark Emery and others did get busted for selling seeds, but we just kept doing it, and we've overgrown the government on these campaigns. And so now I wanted to finish that campaign to go past the final frontier of marijuana, which is being able to grow it openly and freely. That, to me, is what legalization is about. And so I've acquired a very large number of cannabis seeds, over 2 million seeds I have now. There a lot of them are marijuana seeds that are high THC, but the vast majority are high CBD seeds that will produce a nice plant about 5 feet tall with a big central cola. They'll make, you know, around 8 to 12% CBD if grown outdoors. And this strain, I said, I've got millions of these seeds, and I'm giving them away from coast to coast. I'm doing a national tour. But I got busted a couple of days ago in Calgary and spent the night in jail there.
And I don't know what Canadian jails look like compared to the ones here in the States, but it's never any fun, I'm sure.
Well, it wasn't super fun, but it wasn't that bad either, I have to say. It was the second stop on my tour, and so far we've had six stops so far, and they've all been packed rooms, standing room only. There's a lot of interest in this.
Again, that was Dana Larson, who's doing a Canada nationwide tour giving away marijuana seeds. Part two tomorrow. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show episodes and podcast on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. If you have a show idea or want to help produce Jaws of Justice Radio, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. And you can always listen to us live and find podcasts of our show on the KKFI website, that is kkfi.org. We thank our engineer, Beth Pike, for her work today. My name is Melvin Merritt, asking you to tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Tell Somebody with Tom Claymer on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Beautician Blues with Luscious Liam, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Ho. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day with the spicy Latin sounds of Sabor Latino and Fiesta Musicale.